There are probably kids in the Wisconsin area playing youth baseball and emulating your delivery. Did you ever stop and think about that?
I think that's one of the coolest things. I think that's why we do this. Like I said, just the, I mean, it's a kid's game at the end of the day. We're just all trying to have fun with it. But knowing a kid, watched me on TV, came to a baseball game, and enjoyed how I pitched. And I mean, that's at the end of the day, that's what you want. You want that to touch it. It's just something little just by playing a game, but you could touch kids' heart just by, playing what you love and him obviously having the same passion in the game.
Hey everybody, it's Justin Shackle welcoming you to episode 19 of Toe in the Slab, Pitching with David Cohn, where we try to take you deep into the art of pitching every single show. And we do it with the five-time World Series champ, the Cy Young Award winner, David Cohn, the crack researcher, James Smythe, and myself. And on this podcast for this week, we talk to our first closer, guys. And if you're a fan out there, or maybe even a pitcher out there who is curious about modern arm maintenance, among other topics, David, I think this week's guest really brings something to the table.
Yeah, it's in the modern game, relievers have obviously come to the forefront and they're more important than ever. Starters are going fewer innings, but I can tell you this, that one of the best receptions you will get when a reliever comes in the game in terms of crowd reaction is for Josh Hader. When he walks in from the Milwaukee Brewers bullpen, it is dynamic. The fans love him. He's got a pretty good history going there over the last few years. He is dynamic. That left-handed delivery, it's style, it's dominance. It's his fastball. And now he's, complementing that with other pitches. The secondary pitches have gotten better, but you talk about an exciting reliever the fans really gravitate to and react to. It's Josh Hader right now in today's game, especially in Milwaukee with some of the successes they've had there.
Yeah, when you see Josh on the mound, you see that dominant fastball, obviously, and the way the delivery just flows to the plate, I think it suits his body type so well. We do get into this, but I have this like analogy in my head, like watching him with his delivery motioning to the plate, it's like taking your hand out of a glove because it's glove-like. It fits him so perfectly well, but there's a lot of work that obviously goes into that. So we get into that with Josh. We touch on that type of work that he puts in when it comes to taking care of his arm and his pitching routine. And he also talks about how his manager, Craig Counsell, gets the most out of that Brewers clubhouse. There's one constant there in the NL Central through the last several years. It is Milwaukee, and especially with that pitching staff, I don't think they're going anywhere anytime soon. And we also get to touch on how Josh's admiration for Dontrell Willis plays a role in his pitching. So plenty more with Josh Hader. James, maybe from a statistical standpoint, but some of his accolades, what should we know about Josh Hader?
Flat out, one of the most dominant pitchers in the game, maybe the most dominant, especially when you go on a per inning type of basis. Overwhelming in both limiting runs, 2.26 cure ERA, 1.23 ERA this year, but also strikeouts. That's the name of the game with these modern bullpens, and he's as good at it as any pitcher who's ever lived. 482 career strikeouts in 282 innings is ludicrous. He's been an all-star in each of the last three all-star games, 18, 19, and 21. We didn't have the all-star game in the shortened 2020 season, of course, and he's a three-time Trevor Hoffman Award winner as the best reliever in the National League. He's gotten that award three times. He's dominant, and he's here to stay because he's in his prime, and he's a big part of what the Brewers are doing.
Yeah, and he was really gracious in giving us some quality time here talking about all things pitching, and he has a bevy of hobbies as well, and we talk about some of his stuff that he does off the field. So we'll chat with Josh. We'll get into this week in pitching history, three up, three down, the whole routine, but we start with the opener each and every week. And David, I mean, the CBA developments over the last week or so, there's been activity the last couple of weeks, but a lot has transpired over the last 7 days or so between the league requesting for some federal mediation, the union rejecting that, and then the day that we're recording this here on Monday afternoon, the labor secretary Marty Walsh made it a point to say that he has spoken to the league and the players association about the ongoing negotiations and how he was giving his encouragement for both sides to stay engaged with one another and try and find a resolution. Just when it came to some of those subject matters, when you hear the phrase federal mediation, like what do you make of it all? Because a lot of it happened with you in the 90s when you were playing.
Yes. The mediator's name was Bill Ussery back in 1994, 95. And he was brought in at the last minute after the World Series was canceled. And there was a real impasse, or at least, at least we were close to an impasse. There was two different frameworks. There had been negotiations all winter long. And, you know, that was the time when federal mediator usually is brought in when you're close to an impasse. That's not the case this time. I mean, it was the owners declared a lockout. They waited about 6 weeks before they got to the bargaining table. They seemed to be making some concessions. At least the Players Association felt like they were bargaining in good faith. They were expecting a counterproposal. And now all of a sudden there's this request for a federal mediator. And it just, the timing of it all was suspect. And that's what we're hearing from the Players Association, was that the timing's all wrong. This seems like a PR ploy. Why now? You promised us 2 days ago you were going to make another counteroffer. We seem to be making progress. Let's stay at the table. So yeah, it feels like this, it feels a little orchestrated, right? The initiation of the lockout, the language behind it from Rob Manfred, the commissioner, to the point of now where all of a sudden out of nowhere, we're requesting a federal mediator. You know, I really don't blame the Players Association for rejecting it at this point. I think you should be at the bargaining table still. You know, we're making some progress. Let's try. Let's keep trying this. And so, I understand the sentiment. It kind of felt like, you know, it was out of sorts or out of place at this time, the timing of the request for the mediator.
Yeah, at this time does feel like a little bit of posturing. And also, you heard a lot of chat on social media talking about that period in the 90s, specifically 94, that federal mediation didn't work then. Why would it work now, so to speak? David, why did it not work during the moments leading up to the 94 stoppage?
Well, yeah, the thing is that the owners on their side, I think you have to understand labor law, and the owners, if they can theoretically bargain to an impasse, then the owners and the commissioner can unilaterally implement whatever working rules that their last offer was. So that's the trick of the game, is bargaining in good faith to a legitimate impasse. And once that happens, then the leverage goes to the owner's side. Then they can make, you know, they can unilaterally implement whatever they want at that point. So, you know, the only thing I can think of, and I've said this all along, is that it's always been a three-headed battle. There's large markets versus small markets are the first two phases of this equation. And then the players are kind of the third wheel here. Maybe from a strategy point, Commissioner Manfred was trying to break a log jam between the owners themselves. Maybe that's why he requested the mediator. And that's sort of reading the tea leaves on the Players Association side. Why did they do this now? Do they have a jam up on their side? Are they trying to send a message to the owner's side to break up whatever log jams they have on that side? You know, that's what goes into it on the Players Association side, trying to figure that out, trying to read the messages that are being sent and the timing of everything. And, you know, it was awkward at best. And, you know, I as I said before, you know, unless you know for certain that maybe this was a ploy to break up the small markets and the large markets and get them to the bargaining table, to me, the timing was all wrong. So I understand why it was rejected.
That's interesting. And I'm not trying to, you know, make light of this, like it's some type of, you know, drama feature here, but that would be some subplot, right? The league, because you always associate the league and all of the owners together. Obviously, you probably have that faction of small market owners and big market owners, but then the league pretty much telling that end, hey guys, let's go get it together. Time's a waste and we need to act. And maybe that's why they do.
It's a legitimate concern or a legitimate point, because if you have to understand, out of 30 major league owners, 8 can block anything. If you have a group of 8 owners that get together, they can stop anything. And so if that is the case and the vote is that close, and only the owners know that, only Rob Manfred, the commissioner, knows what the vote tally is on whatever the current offer is, that, you know, that you would just have to think, you know, maybe he's doing this as a ploy to break up that block of eight. Maybe there really is a block of eight, or are they more unified on the owner side? Is there more than eight owners who disagree with the course of the negotiations, or who have specific needs that they want that aren't being addressed? So, you know, it really does become psychological trying to read the messages. And, you know, it is possible. It's very plausible that, you know, maybe there is a block of eight owners that are together that, you know, need to be broken up somehow. And maybe that was a cry for help from the commissioner's office or the lead negotiator, you know, some sort of cry for help. That's where the mediator was requested.
Do you think that could be one of the big factors as to why we have yet to see around the clock negotiating or just more gatherings between the two sides?
You know, that there's always a staking of positions, you know, and the thing that most federal mediators do and most any mediation really is what they call split the baby. So two sides have been staked out. And now all of a sudden you bring in a mediator and you're gearing for the midpoint. So the halfway point, that's how arbitration works. That's how a lot of negotiations work. And, you know, maybe the owners on their side too thought, I like our position the way it is now. If we could get a mediator in, we can live with the halfway point. And that's where the mediator would drive this agreement, the halfway point between where the players are now and where the owners are now. And only they really know all the issues, where they exactly are in terms of all the core economic issues. So yeah, maybe they like their stance right now and they're pushing to get to the midpoint as opposed to continue to negotiate. If you continue to negotiate in good faith and make concessions, the goalposts move in terms of that midpoint. So that, you know, that's part of the overall strategy here is maybe they're trying to trap the midpoint, as they say, on the owner side, and the players want to keep bargaining in good faith. Let's find answers to competitive balance. Let's find answers to tanking, service manipulation. You know, let's keep talking. Let's come up with creative ideas. And the owners might just be saying, you know what, we like our position where it is now, and let's try to trap the midpoint right here.
The more you're talking here, the more you do get a firmer sense of a stall on the owner's side, because what did we have late last week as well? A bunch of players on Twitter kind of talking out, and the common theme was, hey, a big part of a collective bargaining agreement is the bargaining. And they're really showing that the lack of activity. I thought that was really interesting because every player nearly with a Twitter account came together and talked about that. As we take a look here, though, like, we're already a full week into February. Would it be accurate to say that there's maybe roughly 2 weeks left on the calendar before missing games becomes a real possibility?
Unless you can do, you know, a 3-week spring training, which is what was done in 1995, then you're looking at maybe the first week of March as a cutoff date.
Yeah.
Maybe
for pitchers, March. Though, that's tough, though, no?
Well, pitchers are doing their own thing now. They're throwing, you know, a lot of pitchers are way ahead of the game compared to 1995 when some guys didn't pick up a ball the whole offseason. So, yeah, theoretically, you could think that the pitchers are going to be ready to get ramped up. They're doing their side sessions. A lot of them have their private facilities that they go to now anyway with all of that modern technology. So it's a different game, a different animal. But you could still do a 3-week spring training and start the season pretty close to on time. And to me, that brings the deadline closer to the first week in March.
Right. And looking at some of the historical work stoppages, sometimes there was a strike or a lockout that delayed the start of spring training, or the players went on strike during spring training and it lasted a week or 2 weeks. And it didn't really shake up the overall season where they were still able to start on time. So if spring training is shortened by a week, they'll just move forward with the regular opening day setup and just work around that. So I think there is a little bit of cushion just because pitchers and catchers were supposed to meet on this date and spring training games are supposed to start on this date. Doesn't necessarily mean that if we pass that, then it's all over.
Yeah, the days are flying off the calendar. It's going to be interesting. And it just feels like it's going to go down to the wire, just like everything in this damn sport, this lovely but damn sport, right?
It always works that way. It's frustrating, but there's a rhythm and a timing to big negotiations. Collective bargaining agreements just don't happen overnight. You know, there's always a gauging and a regauging and leverage points pressured. And at the last minute, you finally find out, you know, okay, where you stand. Okay, now's the time to make a deal. And then all of a sudden you make a deal. And it always happens that way at the last minute. And there's always going to be both sides testing each other to see their to test their resolve. Are the players really going to stick together? Will they, you know, you hear a statement from a player somewhere that says, hey, I want to play baseball. And the next thing you know, the owners are saying, see, we got them. We got them. They're going to crack. They're going to crack. So there's always that gauging, that finger to the wind sort of thing that goes on in collective bargaining.
All right, let's get to Brewers closer Josh Hader here on this week. A fantastic guest. He really gave us some great insight on a bunch of topics as it relates to what he shows on the mound, how he gets ready, and some inspirations that I would not have thought of until he said it. But then once he did, it really made a lot of sense. So he touches on a lot of great subjects here with us on Toeing the Slab. This week's episode, beg your pardon, this week's guest on Toeing the Slab, pitching with David Cone, it is Milwaukee Brewers closer Josh Hader. Josh, thank you so much for taking some time with us here this week. You are our first closer on Toeing the Slab, so congratulations for what it's worth. But there are a lot of things that we want to talk about here with you and the way you kind of take advantage of your body type on the mound and maximize all your athletic abilities. But to start off here, man, you're making content. You have your own YouTube channel. And I have to say, it's really entertaining. You had this original series, Haterade's World, episode one. You did that. You had a whole video on what goes into your throwing routine. But I have a bone to pick with you, man, because there's been one new upload in 8 months. So what gives here? Why'd you put a pause on making such awesome content?
Well, I appreciate you having me on. You know, one of the main reasons is during the fall, which is roughly right after the season, you know, get into the hunting world. So that's a little behind, but it's gonna make a little appearance here pretty soon. And you know, once baseball season hits, I'm full go on that. So limited on what the content I'm producing. Hopefully, to change that moving forward.
Are you editing this stuff? I mean, John Boy Media is hiring content creators. So
no editing on my part. I tell you what, that's probably one of the hardest things to do. I have tons of videos. It's the editing part that slows me down.
So David, there's a video of Josh just taking everyone through his warm-up routine, and it involves a lot of work with resistant bands and some small weights, but also Josh talks about the benefits of doing Pilates and how these techniques can really help serve pitchers. And I think it doesn't matter what your body type is. I think Pilates could probably be beneficial to everyone. Josh, what have been the benefits for you with Pilates? Because I know it's something that you kind of incorporated in recent years. It's not something that's been with you since the start of your baseball journey.
Yeah, I think it's been a big key in my training regimen. I think my wife introduced me to it. She used to do it a lot, and I tried it out one time, and it just allowed me to have a lot of body awareness and really feel the parts that, you know, on a reformer where you're moving, standing up sometimes, it kind of gives you that ground force to where that you need in pitching. So it kind of helps me just continue to use my body in the best way I can.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing that I've noticed when we talk to a lot of pitchers, Josh, and thanks again for coming on Toeing with the Slab. You know, the training method seemed to have changed almost overnight, even since you've been in the big leagues. It seems like, you know, guys have gone from no weight rooms back in the 80s and 90s to massive weightlifting, getting strong, and now kind of reverting back to more, you know, like you said, Pilates or more targeted specific type training for pitchers. I mean, how much do you use? You throw the weighted balls. What do you do differently now that you've seen in the big leagues in your time so far than when you first broke in?
I think it's just reading your body more. I think the weight program is still there. You know, obviously adding Pilates is another benefit on my regimen that I use, but I think it goes hand in hand. I think you can't really stay on one side or the other. I think you continue to, obviously you need strength through the weights and the power that builds that. And then, you know, just being able to mobilize that strength in the muscles. So you're able to lengthen those. And I think that also helps me out through an entire season as well.
Yeah, it feels like you gained a couple ticks on your fastball. I mean, you've always had a great fastball, and that, you know, maybe going just strictly to the closer role last year, it looked like maybe you bumped up a couple notches, like 96 plus on a regular average fastball velocity level. Is that something you attribute to your offseason training, or more of a specific role as to just being the closer now?
Yeah, I think that also helps, just the program that I've been through. I actually started getting onto a really good arm program. You know, Blair was able to, with the Brewers, he's been able to help me, you know, really get on a program. And then, you know, being throughout the season, Dave and everybody else able to kind of tune me in depending on my workload. And I think arm care is also a key role to that, you know, speed bump up. And then just knowing my mechanics and trying to repeat them the best I can.
You mentioned arm care. How has that evolved from the time that you turned pro to where we are now going into the 2022 season?
It's definitely grown on me. You know, when I first came into the big leagues or even professional baseball, you know, I would just take 5-pound dumbbells and basically do my YTs and that's it and call it a day. Obviously I had bands incorporated into that, but nowadays it's more kettlebells, you know, kind of just mixing in between that and a lot of scap work. And that's really been a big success for me.
Any weighted balls? Do you throw the weighted balls at all? Or have you incorporated that?
I've tried a little bit. I mostly do the reverse throws. I don't really like throwing the weighted two going forward, but you know, I think that's one of the things that are hitter, you know, you really pick what you like and add that to it. And I think that's just anything that you learn throughout the game is you'll find things that work better for you and, you know, things that don't. So it's not always a program that you follow. It's kind of your own program that you kind of assort throughout playing.
We have James Smythe here too, Josh, and he's kind of a historian. You know, he covers a lot of ground and fills in the blanks, makes us all a little smarter. So I'd like to turn it over to him and tell us a little bit about Josh Hader's career. It's been remarkable so far, you know, in 4 or 5 years now, what a mark he's made.
Yeah. So, I mean, how much time do we have?
yeah, exactly.
So Josh, just to give a little rundown for the listeners here, 3-time All-Star, top four in the NL in saves in each of the last 3 years, 3-time Trevor Hoffman Award winner as the National League's best reliever, 2018, 2019, teammate Devin Williams got it in 2020, and then you got it back in 2021. So 3 out of 4 there. Absolutely dynamite with all three pitches. And this year was the leader. We mentioned win probability added in a show a week or so, guys. And this one, this year, 4.8 win probability added, best in the major league. So out of all big league pitchers last year, can't really say anybody else had a more direct impact on their team winning games than Josh because of the high leverage pitching. One thing I wanted to ask you about was how have you dealt with the different change in your usage? So if we look at 2019, you had 15 saves of 4+ outs. That didn't just lead the major leagues. That was the most by any pitcher in any season since John Smoltz back in 2004. So it was very unusual at the time to have a multi-inning, multi-out, 4+ out type of closer there. Now, this year, more of a traditional one inning, come in, strike out the side in the ninth and call it a day. How has the different usage affected you?
It's helped a lot. It's helped through health throughout the season. It's helped me kind of gauge and know exactly how my body's feeling to, you know if I can go 3 in a row. So I think that's been the biggest thing is just the health part of it. You know, also I think what helped me out a lot was my routine. It helped me build a routine, going into the game and knowing exactly what I needed to be ready. So when that ninth came, I was at my best ability, you know, warming up and then going into the game.
Josh, is there something that generally tells you? Maybe it varies, but is there a boilerplate arrival in your mind that can tell you, hey, I'm good for multiple innings tonight, or I can go back-to-back games or three straight games?
Yeah, I think it's the three straight games. I mean, obviously, it depends on the workload that you have those first two. Now, if you have, you know, a pretty quick second inning or second game, and, you know, you have a night game following that, I mean, obviously, going in from a night to a day game, that's a quick turnaround. But it also depends on how you're feeling through that. But I think it's helped me just, you know the body, you can feel exactly if your legs. I mean, for me, it's about my body, my legs, my lower half, and how that feels. Because, I mean, once you get on the mound, you're not going to feel your arm anyways.
You know, the interesting part for me is you know, I ask a lot of pitchers similar type questions because I'm curious. You know, I retired in 2003. You know, I played for 17 years as a pitcher. And, you know, I'm fascinated with all the new toys and technology, and some pitchers like it. Pitch, you know, they want to know their numbers. Other pitchers still pitch by feel. And I was curious with you, you know, it's such a dynamic delivery, the way you coil, the way you do use your whole body, the deception that's built into that delivery. And then secondly, how do you know when you get out of whack? Do you use the numbers? Do you know everything that's available to you in a progressive organization like the Milwaukee Brewers? Do you know what your vertical and horizontal movements are? Do you know your inside numbers or your release point in terms of outing to outing, and how you get right when things are going on, you know, offline a little bit?
Honestly, I don't focus too much in the numbers. I couldn't tell you exactly what my bird or any of that stuff is. For me, my biggest thing is feel. You know, I'm a feel guy. Even when I'm pitching, you know, if I'm getting off, there's spots where I hit in the strike zone that if I'm missing, that tells me, you know, this is going on. You need to, you know, for instance, if I'm missing arm side up and away, I mean, that's a pretty generic one, but, you know, I'm opening my front half and I need to stay on that a little bit longer, maybe ride that slope down. That's kind of one of the easiest ones, but that's just an example of kind of how I feel and I see the results that kind of tell me if I'm working well down the mound, or, you know, my arm path is clean, you know, if I'm cutting the ball, whatnot. So there's multiple things that kind of I've been able to pick up just through my career, learn out. There's just really feel the ground and how you get down the mound.
Yeah, that I love that answer. You know, the ball flight doesn't lie. For young pitchers out there, if you're looking to make quick adjustments, what Josh just said is so important, because where the ball travels and where you're intending it to travel tells a story. And you can, you know, you can have your own checklist, and if it's up and away, if you're missing up and away, if you're late, if you're hanging on to it too far and you're yanking it down and away, there's certain mechanical adjustments you can make right away. That's part of the field game. I think it's a little bit lost. I love that answer for young pitchers, to pay attention to the ball flight. It tells a story without a doubt.
Absolutely.
David, I love when you ask some of these pitchers if they concentrate on some of the metrics and whether they know about their axis and stuff like that. And a lot of the pitchers we talk to have seriously nasty stuff, just like Josh. And it's a lot of fun to hear when they say, no, I just rely on feel, or, you know, I just focus on feel. And Josh, we had Corbin Burns on a few weeks after he won the Cy Young. And he said he doesn't like to look at the numbers during the season. He waits until maybe the off season or during spring training to concentrate on that. But during the year, he generally relies on his feel, but he also relies heavily on the self-evaluation process that an organization like the Brewers have kind of incorporated. And you're seeing that with several teams throughout the game. What is your self-evaluation process like after you pitch, maybe the day after? What are you looking at?
Right after I pitch, you know, I think the biggest thing for me, I wait till I get in the car and I'll rewatch the game. And I'll focus on kind of what my intent was for that pitch. You know, what result did that give? Did that give me a swing and miss? How did he take this pitch? So I kind of analyze that. I don't think about it too much, but I just kind of, I want to know what I'm doing and if I'm doing that right as the result. So, you know, I try and keep it as simple as possible. This game is hard enough. And the more you start thinking about it, the more you carry that into the next day. And I think that's one of the biggest things that, us as ball players, we can do that a lot. We can carry You know, whether that's within an at bat and you make a bad pitch, you carry that on to the next pitch. So I think for me, it's seeing it right in my face, knowing what I wanted to do, and then erasing it from the memory bank and moving on.
We touched a moment ago or so about using your legs, kind of knowing when to push the limit based on your legs, your lower half. I think when fans watch you, one of the things that must stand out is the delivery, that corkscrew leg kick. And I see that. I see your body type. And for me, it just screams, hey, this is custom made, right? This looks like this belongs with this certain body type. How'd you discover the leg kick that you have where you're kind of recoiling? And just mechanically, what do you think that type of motion does for you? What is that setup?
I think it's evolved over the time. In high school, I was really different. You know, growing up, Dontrell Willis was a big guy that had the crazy high leg kick, and kind of followed me. You know, obviously being a lefty, it's kind of one of the things that I enjoyed watching. Moving on from that, going to the Orioles organization, made a few minor adjustments to my delivery where my lower half was syncing up with my upper half. And that actually helped me get a little bit more velocity, stayed fluent through my mechanics, and just continued to learn how to move with my body. And I think that was probably the key thing for me is, you know, just continuing to learn. And I think getting down the mound was the biggest thing.
It feels like, you know, I covered your postseason series a couple of years ago for Fox. And to me, the loudest cheers I heard was when you were called in the game, running in from the bullpen, and the reaction that you've gotten there in Milwaukee now, and now obviously progressing to the more traditional type closer. I mean, what's that feel like when you come in, when you bust through the gates, you feeling that effect from the crowd, you getting that rush, or are you more of you just trying to block everything out and stay focused on your job at hand?
No, absolutely. Coming out there and hearing the fans scream, I think that's one of the coolest things ever. You know, no matter how long you play, no matter how long you hear that, it still gives you chills. It gets you excited. You know, I think that's one of the biggest things is why I play this game is for the interaction with the fans and being able just to, we're all enjoying the game of baseball right then and there. And I think that's the coolest thing. And, you know, once I get on the mound, that's when I zone focus and, you know, really lock it in. But, you know, that's my trip from the bullpen to the mound. That's when I get to just embrace everything and enjoy that moment.
Yeah, it just seems like the Milwaukee fan base has embraced you so much because you've come through, you know, in the time you've been there. So that's one of the exciting parts of the games. You know, people are talking about starting pitchers nowadays and too many relievers, too many pitching changes. But yeah, to me, when you see Josh Hader come in the game and you see the crowd react like that, boy, that's exciting to me. And that's the way it's been since he's really been in Milwaukee. He's the guy when that bullpen door opens, boy, the crowd lights up. And to me, that's pure excitement, you know, and I can't imagine you don't just float in from the bullpen on that and really lift you up. I know I did when I pitched. I loved the crowd and kind of feeding off of that emotion and trying to keep it under control at the same time. But, you know, you're a fun guy to watch up there in Milwaukee, man. When you come in there, it's lights out and it's exciting. And, you know, one question I had was, you know, your manager, Craig Counsell, has got such a reputation for being so progressive and new school on the communication side. And as your role has evolved, you know, what's your impressions there? Has he always told you ahead of time what he's looking for from you? Or is it sort of like, hey, whenever you need me, I'm ready. Just call down there.
Counts has been one of the greatest managers I've ever played for. I think the communication standpoint on his end, you know, it's key. It's, you know, one of the things is you feel like you're really connected with him. That's one of the things coming in every year is he wants us to feel connected. You know, we're a family. We're there with each other, you know, 6 months out of the year. And I think that's one of the biggest things as a clubhouse is that's what you want. You want to be able to feel relaxed, feel easy going around each other and be able to communicate. At the end of the day, that's all we can ever ask for is to be on the same page with each other.
Hear that from a lot of Brewer players, that sense of connection that Craig Counsell provides to his clubhouse. So I'm just doing the math in my head as we're talking here. So Josh, you're 27 now, and you mentioned looking up at Dontrell Willis and that pronounced leg kick when he came onto the scene. You had to be around 7 or 8 or so when Dontrell Willis really exploded and fans really took notice. I mean, the Marlins won in 2003, the World Series. He was on that team. Were you, as a little leaguer, or, you know, when you're going through grammar school, middle school, are you exaggerating with that leg kick on the mound as much as Dontrell Willis was, or are you trying to be Dontrell?
Absolutely. One, I got to find this picture, see if I can bring it up for you guys. But we went to Cooperstown 1 year, Dreams Park. And I think that was the one time I remember seeing a picture that we had. And I remember I tried to get that leg as high as possible. And, you know, obviously you feel like you're doing it as a kid, but, you know, I probably wasn't as high as him, but, you know, that was, I mean, he was the dream, you know, that's what you do. You imitate your guys, and you feel awesome when you're doing it as a little kid as well.
You're probably like there, there's a lot of moving parts to that as well, but then you're likely hitting your spots and you're saying to yourself, yeah, I think this could work. Yeah, this is what we could go with for sure. And then David, you're talking about coming out of the bullpen, the rush that you must get from Milwaukee fans. And then when you think about it, with the way you have your delivery set up, there are probably kids in the Wisconsin area playing youth baseball and emulating your delivery. Did you ever stop and think about that?
You know, I think that's one of the coolest things. I think that's why we do this. Like I said, you know, just it's a kid's game at the end of the day. We're just all trying to have fun with it. But knowing a kid, you know, watched me on TV, came to a baseball game, and enjoyed how I pitched. And I mean, that's at the end of the day, that's what you want. You want that to touch, you know, it's just something little just by playing a game, but you know, you could touch kids' heart just by, you know, playing what you love, and him obviously having the same passion in the game.
David, James, did you ever try to be anyone when you were young and playing youth baseball?
Yeah, I was just kidding. You were mind melding here. Yeah, absolutely. You know me. I've talked about him, Louis Tian threw sidearm sliders, and he turned his back, and similar to Josh a little bit. I mean, he had this wild delivery and all these glove movements all through his delivery. So he was charismatic to me. I don't know, James, who'd you watch growing up?
I couldn't pull off the Hideo Nomo spin all the way around thing. So, yeah. But I mean, as far as just hitting Paul O'Neill with a little toe tap.
Yes, there you go. That's 90s. You're a 90s kid. That's right.
Yeah. I had this batting stance of Andres Galarraga because I was a little afraid of getting hit by the pitch. So I would have my lead foot step out toward first base, and he always had that wide open stance. So that front foot was back, and it would, you know, you'd take the step up instead of out toward the pitcher. So that was taught to me. And I'm like, oh, this is what I kind of need to do if I, you know, want to make an impact. So the big cat, Andres Galarraga, was definitely for me. Josh, some mechanical stuff that I wanted to touch on going back to 2021, because you started throwing a changeup a lot more to offer a little bit of variety between the fastball and the slider, but it's not something that you just discovered. You've kind of always had a changeup in your back pocket, but what was telling you how or when to introduce it to opponents?
You know, I had a changeup when I was a starter. I think that was a big pitch for me. Didn't use it as much as I wanted to. Going into the big leagues, you know, I got away with the first 2 years being able to use my fastball a lot more. Obviously, with these hitters, these guys they're going to know what you throw. They're going to know your location, and they're great hitters. So you got to adjust. If you don't adjust, then that's how you get left behind. And I think for me, I added the slider, and the slider started to play good, but then I only had one side of the plate covered. So that changeup allowed me to cover both sides of the plate. And, you know, obviously the hitter is going to tell me when I should break it out, but just being able to attack both sides of the plate, with three different speeds have been, it's been game changing for me. And obviously I don't throw the changeup, a big percentage by any means, but, just throwing it in here and there and in at bat can really throw off the timing of a hitter.
And do you, Do you know coming in the bullpen, you know, I mean, I know it can be tricky, you know, how you warm up, especially as a reliever, you feel great. And then you get on the mound, it's not quite there. It's tricky. Are you the type that just follows the lead of the catcher, or are you driving the bus? Are you shaking off? You know exactly what you want to throw, or do you kind of follow the lead a la Mark Burley used to do with the White Sox?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think, you know, Omar and when we had Manny, I think, you know, they knew exactly what they wanted to do with the hitters. I mean, they've been catching the whole game, so they know and they can read these hitters. Obviously, knowing myself and knowing what works best for me, you know, if I feel a situation where I need to throw a different pitch, I'll shake to it. But at the end of the day, I feel like we're on a pretty good, you know, combinations throughout and knowing what we feel is best. So just trusting the catcher as well. I think that's the biggest thing at the end of the day, when you're spending from spring training on and just having them multiple years, it's, you know, what you're looking for, and you know, what you really want to throw. You know, I don't think the hitter coming forward really tells you exactly what you want to throw, but reading that bat and reading the swings, I think that's what you make the adjustments throughout.
So you expand the pitch variety in 2021. And at the same time here, you cut down your barrel percentage at an extreme rate, pretty much like by 50%. It was a little over 12.5 in 2019. It was 14.7% in 2020. And then last year it dropped to 6.3%. Do you think that concentrated pitch variety helped lead to less barrels in 2021?
100%. And also, I think I've been able to locate my fastball a little bit better than I have been in the past. But obviously, adding the two different speeds has been a big help. You know, if you get a guy out front a little bit on a breaking ball or a changeup, you know, he's not going to have that barrel control because he may be expecting that fastball. So being able to mix it up a lot, I think that's probably been the key just in general for my success.
Success is there. So
yes. Go, James.
No, just to jump in here. So the fastballs percentage has been going down from, you know, 70, 80s, now down to 65. But batting averages for all three pitches: 103 against the fastball, 159 against the slider, 176 against the changeup. Over 30% strikeout rate in all three pitches. And what really jumped out to me was that the swing and miss rate, the whiff rate, was 40%+ on all three pitches, including the changeup, which is a little bit newer into the fold.
Unfair, right? Unfair advantage. Closer with three pitches and getting that kind of swing and miss rate. It is remarkable when you think about it. And you know, it's a mindset too, I guess. When you know you have those weapons in your back pocket, man, that's a confidence builder, especially for a closer. You're coming in and maybe, you know, the third straight game, you know, you can mix in your changeup. I know, especially the right-handed batters a little bit more. You know, that extra weapon, man, that's got to be a confidence builder for you.
Absolutely. And I think, and like you said, that's the biggest thing is knowing that if you're going three in a row, you have that secondary to help you get away, because your fastball realistically isn't going to be what it was that first game you came out. So, you know, being able to mix it up is huge.
How do you feel about genuine emotion on the mound? Let's say if you punch out a guy with the bases loaded, big strikeout, you give it the fist pump or the bat flip generation. Any, I mean, if it's authentic emotion, you okay with it? Or is there a fine line still there for you, a little bit old school in that regard?
No, I mean, I think everybody plays this game with different passion and they show their emotions differently. I think at the end of the day, you show your emotion as long as it's not directed towards me or my team. So be it. We play this game. We know how hard this game is. If you want to celebrate and do your thing, so be it. Do it. But I think you draw that line when it's directed at you or the team.
Hey, which hitter brings out the best version of Josh Hader?
Man, there's a few. You know, Freddie Freeman, he's been a good one for me. You know, obviously ending the season last year with that homer, but just that bat he puts up against me, it's been a fun split with him. Freddie's just he's got really good eye of the strike zone. So You know, trying to get him off guard is very tough to do. You know, Rizzo was another guy. I think it's funny if you think about it, you don't think lefties would be the hard one to face, but you know, Rizzo and Freddie have been fun to play against.
And don't worry though, you're not the only pitcher who probably utters those names. I'm pretty sure Freddie Freeman is a common answer for that, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. We'd be remiss, man, if we didn't extend a belated congratulations. We saw on your Instagram that you're going to be a dad for the first time later this year. Congrats there.
Absolutely. Thank you. We're excited about it. Baby boy coming in 4th of July. So,
wow. Nice.
Big news for us.
That's a game changer.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are you most excited for about being a dad?
I think it's just learning life again, learning to enjoy the little things in life. You know, I feel like I don't have a kid, but I feel like once you go through that memory and you go through the stages and the steps, you know, you learn to just enjoy the little things of life and enjoy each day as it is.
At the very top, we were talking about your content production. You were talking about some of the hunting content that you provide. You got a lot of hobbies. You hunt, you fish, you like to golf. But, and David could probably attest to this too. Look, the laws of parenting and time, they kind of say that you're not going to be able to do all of those hobbies once you become a parent. So what is kind of non-negotiable for you here? What do you have to make time for?
Hunting, man. I think at the end of the day, hunting is the one I have to do. Whitetail bow hunting is probably one of the favorite things I do. Learned it in probably junior year of high school. My buddy showed me how to do it and loved it ever since. I think that was one of the biggest things for me, being able to get out in the woods, nature, and just that's my peace of mind. Just keep it quiet and just watch animals do their thing. I think you don't have to harvest an animal to enjoy it. I think it's just fun time to be out there.
Well, that's the hobby that you can justify because look, you got extra mouths to feed now. So it's the one that you know, it's not like going out on the golf course for half the day and kind of not coming back with anything. So that's a good one to justify. So as we wrap things up here, one thing we like to do on Toe in the Slab is that for every guest that comes on the pod, we end it by giving the guest the chance to ask something to an upcoming guest on the podcast. So we're going to tell you the name of a guest that's coming on the show. You're going to have to quickly come up with a question to ask them. And we're going to save that question. We're going to relay it to them when they appear on the pod. But first, we need to backtrack. We need to give you your question from a prior guest on Toe in the Slab. And that guest is the pitching ninja, Rob Friedman. He was our guest on our prior episode. So here is what the ninja had for you.
I want to know like kind of when he realized that his fastball was as unhittable as it is. Was there any analytics based on that? Was it hitter based off hitters? And what does he think makes that special in his own mind? Like, how is he able to get his fastball to get on a plane to miss so many bats? I know, is it the arms and legs and the weird, you know, kind of the weird arm slot? Is there a special trick that he does with his hand to try to get a little bit of rise on the ball? What is it? Like, I want to know what the key to that is.
What do you have, Josh?
I think the trick is the deception one. I think the second thing is, as a kid growing up, I think, you know, my dad didn't want me throwing a curveball or an off speed like that. So I ride and die by my fastball ever since then. Even when I was throwing, you know, 80 miles per hour in high school, I think that was the biggest thing, is I needed to locate that fastball, because at the end of the day, you're not going to throw a slider or a curveball or a changeup, you know, 70% of the time. You know, when you get behind, you're not going to throw a curveball most times at a young age. So, you know, I learned to use my fastball at the top of the zone inside. And I think that's where I made my success, because, you know, I wasn't scared to go inside, or, you know, if I missed, I brushed a guy back. Like, I wasn't scared to do that again. I knew I wasn't going to hurt anybody. I knew that I had the confidence in that. And that's what kind of grew with me, is I had the confidence no matter what. And then just learning the other pitches, kind of what brought everything else back together. You know, I was able to control that slider, which then made the fastball location a little bit better, because I could feel that finger pressure and release. So I think it was a big mix on all that.
That's as solid of an answer, I think, Pitching Ninja is going to get there. That was very nice. Yeah. But yeah,
go right back to high school, right? Yeah, right back to high school. And his dad's advice to him, you know, you learn how to throw that fastball where you want to. That's great advice.
All right. So one of our upcoming guests here, as it's your turn to ask a question, he is he's a pitcher that made his big league debut at the very end of last season. So he's young here, and he's someone whose stuff is off the charts, the charts as a big time prospect here. So Josh, if you can ask one question for Tampa Bay Rays right-hander Shane Boz, what would it be?
Does it have to be pitching related?
Could be anything you want.
Okay. What was your greatest memory coming to the show? Was it going to the stadium? You know, was it being in the clubhouse, seeing the ballpark, smelling the grass? What was it? And also, what is your favorite stadium that you played in? That's a double. That's a double whammy. I don't know if we can do that on the podcast, but
we'll make time for it.
All good.
Although the grass may smell a little different than most grasses at the Trop, but
yeah, exactly.
Maybe, off the top of my head, I'm not sure if it was a home debut or a road debut.
So. Yeah, I'm not sure either. But if it was a turf, that makes sense.
Awesome.
I love the question, though. It's great. Yeah,
very good. Because you could tell, if you're a big leaguer, those moments, yes, you're able to probably slow them down, right, guys?
I felt like I was running underwater when I came in from the bullpen and my first appearance in the big leagues. I mean, it was surreal. It was like I couldn't get to the mound, you know? My legs were moving, but everything felt heavy. You know, it was just so emotional. It's a great question.
Awesome. Josh, thanks so much for the time, man. We appreciate it. You continue to light it up on the mound. And look, we have high expectations for you in 2022. I'm sure you have them for yourself as well, and that's what makes it fun. So best of luck to you, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Appreciate it, guys. It's been a pleasure having me on, and it's great to see you guys. Take care and enjoy everything.
You too. Thank you, Josh.
David, I thought one of the questions you asked him was really interesting about following the lead of the catcher, or if Josh was the one driving the bus, so to speak. What do you think the split of that dynamic is like around Major League Baseball? How many pitchers would you say call their own shots? How many pitchers are following the lead of the backstop?
You know, it's different for short relievers. You know, they have less pitches to work with. Generally, they go with their top two pitches, and a starter that's trying to get two times through the order, maybe potentially three times through the order, they're going to maybe shake off a little bit, because your feel can change inning to inning. But, you know, it depends on the personality. And I always use Mark Burley as an example, and I contrast him with Steve Traxel. Steve Traxel was a pitcher who was nicknamed the human rain delay, because he would shake off, and he really was in the selective process, really jammed up by the selection process instead of the execution process. And for some pitchers, it's better to take that burden off of your mind. Mark Burley was, tell me where you want it, I'll throw it there. I don't want to worry about the selection process. I want to focus on the glove, the target, the quality of the pitch. And it worked exceptionally well for him. He's a borderline Hall of Famer right now, Mark Burley. So yeah, that strategy could work for certain guys, other guys, not so much. It depends on the feel in your hand, the ball, whether you feel like you're spinning it as good inning to inning. It can change inning to inning. So it's different for a starter than a reliever. For Josh Hader, occasionally I would say he might want to shake his head and say, you know, I feel a really good fastball here. I feel like I could really add or hump up on this one, or maybe snap off a slider. Maybe I got a feel. So sometimes you get a ball in your hand, it feels different. The seams feel different, and you convince yourself, hey, this grip's going to work. Let me just throw this pitch. And with conviction, sometimes that works. Even if it's the wrong pitch, from a sequence standpoint, you know, the quality of the pitch is better because you have conviction behind it. And that's always the catch 22 for pitchers, throwing the pitch with conviction as opposed to throwing the right pitch.
That phrase, I always hear it you know, constantly, and James, I see you smirking too. That's like one of the, if you know, you're making another book about David Cone sayings, pitching with conviction is going to be one of the quotes pasted in there for sure. And it always kind of just pops up into my head whenever I'm watching pitching on any game broadcast. All right, this week in pitching history, James, what do you have for us as we enter the second week of February here, man?
It's a little tougher. A lot of the player movement is usually died down around this time of year. Spring training hasn't quite started yet, but I think I got one with a bang here. So
we never doubted you.
February 11, 2001, that's 21 years ago Friday, Pittsburgh's Three River Stadium is imploded. It was the home of the Pirates and the Steelers from 1970 to 2000. Hosted two World Series that they won, 1971 and 1979. Hosted the first World Series night game in 1971. Two All-Star games in 1974. And in 94, Coney, you pitched in that one, saw three no-hitters. Now, what I wanted to get to tie in with Coney here is I think, David, you and your era of pitching had a really great spread in you were based in both eras. So you started your career, a lot of those old cookie cutter AstroTurf garbage stadiums were really still in use. The places like Three River Stadium and Riverfront and the Vet and all these other places. But you were around, and your prime and into the later part of your career was the boom of retro ballparks and all the newer ballparks that we have now. So, Coney, you pitched in 35 MLB parks and 15 of them are still in use. So what do you think the differences are as far as even the mound or just in general, the facilities that, you know, players were using in the 80s and early 90s compared to the late 90s, 2000s.
Yeah. You know, you almost have to get into economics in terms of, you know, dual use stadiums, and it makes sense for the municipalities in terms of an investment. You know, I'm not an economist, you know, there's different economists that'll argue that till the cows come home in terms of whether it's transfer dollars, whether it really works. We should have dual use stadiums. They were ugly. The AstroTurf was hard as a rock. The mounds were inconsistent because they had to break them down for football, especially when the seasons overlapped. So yes, there were some mounds that looked crooked. You know, I got on the mound at Three River Stadium one time, and I looked at home plate looked like it was off center to me because they had to break down the mound to build it back up because they had a Steelers game. So, yeah, I mean, that was what I was dealing with back then. It was like, this doesn't look right. And I think there was an NBA game where Luka Doncic said the rim's crooked a couple nights ago. And
Friday night.
He was right. Right. That was kind of how I felt on the mound sometimes with some of those old stadiums and where the mounds were broken down and rebuilt, you know, several times throughout the year. So, you know, at Camden Yards was a game changer. You know, when we first saw Camden Yards, it brought back the nostalgia, it brought back the intimacy, the quirkiness of baseball dimensions is kind of what sets it apart, you know, from different sports, you know, basketball, you know, the court's the same. The arena may be different, but the playing surface is the same. Same with football, but baseball, that's the beauty of baseball, right? The quirkiness of some of these ballparks. So bringing Camden Yards brought that back. San Francisco was huge. Go from Candlestick Park to what they built in the China Basin down there is just remarkable. We opened that up too, the Yankees in an exhibition game. We were one of the first ones to play there. So, yeah, I mean, it was really interesting. It made you feel special if you're a ball player and you got to play in a new park like that. You know, if you were the first members of the Orioles to play in Camden Yards or the first members of the Giants to play out there at Pac Bell or whatever it was called back then in the China Basin, you know, that made you feel like, wow, you know, this is important. It made you feel good. It made you feel more important. It made you feel like you had a real home. So it did psychologically. It made a big difference. Economically, that's an argument for another show and another day.
Cosmetically, I will add that watching NFL football as a young kid and seeing some of those games at Candlestick or at Oakland Coliseum and watching the NFL players run through the baseball infield was like the ugliest sight that you can possibly see. It just did not make for a good aesthetic watching NFL games as a kid. All right, three up, three down as we close out the show here this week. James, lead us off.
All right, well, I'll stay in the football intruding into baseball thing. So this is a football on a baseball field. You guys might have heard of the Super Bowl being played this coming Sunday, Cincinnati Bengals versus the Los Angeles Rams. All I'm hoping for is that the game is better than the one baseball postseason series between Cincinnati and LA in MLB history. 1995 NLDS, the Reds swept the Dodgers 3-0. Combined score 22-7. They beat them up, and it was a blowout. I hope we get a good game on Sunday. That Reds team had Barry Larkin in his MVP season and three good pitching performances in that series. Pete Shurick, John Smiley, and David Wells shutting it down for the Reds. They went to the NLCS, lost to the Braves. That NLDS series against the Dodgers, that's the last time the Reds have won a postseason series. The only team that has gone longer since their last playoff round victory is the Pirates from 1992.
Wow. Yeah, the David Wells deadline pickup in 95, no?
Yeah, and he pitched well down the stretch. He pitched well for them in the postseason. Maybe that's something that makes that made the Yankees go, hey, you know, this guy can pitch in October. We need this guy.
You know, the old school term for Boomer was he had a rubber arm. He really did. I mean, he had Tommy John surgery early in his career and got it out of the way. But since that point, his arm was unbelievable. He could, I guarantee you right now, he's 58 years old. He could throw batting practice right now. He right out of bed. You know, his arm still is just like rubber.
The question is, Woody, what do you want him?
Yeah, exactly. That's another question.
All right. For me, just a quick recommendation, really. A few great baseball reads that I want to direct some listeners to. The first is from Jesse Rogers, who did a great job supplying us, and you probably heard this on Talking Baseball and perhaps on Baseball Today with Chris and Trevor, but Jesse supplied us with some really informative pieces on the lockout, the CBA talks, specifically the first were the dates that we really need to know about as it pertains to spring training being delayed or spring games being missed, or even if regular season games are in jeopardy. So that's a great timeline to kind of keep with you as we go through the lockout. But the other one came out on Monday this week. Jesse and Andrew Miller spoke, and Andrew is part of the MLBPA executive subcommittee. He's a board member there, and Andrew did a nice job detailing why the players are fighting for specific elements and kind of lifts part of the curtain on the negotiation. So definitely want to forward you to that article. But then the other is an excellent mailbag series put up by Eno Saris and Lindsay Adler at The Athletic. We all three of us love each of their work, and it's cool that they collaborated on this. And this is obviously more fun to learn about than any like labor negotiations. So we really highlight this one, but it answers a lot of fan questions about analytics and which advanced metrics are important to front offices. So they do a great job at simplifying some of these answers. And I think it's a good read. It helps you understand where the game's at today. I think it'll make you a smarter baseball fan. So those are some of my really favorite things to read lately. I wanted to share them here.
It's a great lead because that is really, you know, what our podcast is all about, right? The old school and the new school, and trying to educate and peel back the layers and, you know, pay respects to both sides of the baseball fan, you know, whether you, you like the numbers or you don't, or you're anti analytics or not. You know, it's hard to be anti anything if you don't understand it. So it helps, you know, if you want to push back on something that you think is detrimental to the style of the game that you prefer, you know, it's good to learn about it and push back on it. I think that's why those articles are so great. I mean, you know, Lindsay and Eno are two of the best in the business. As you said, we're big fans of them. And Lindsay does a great job of explaining that as to why maybe there is an older disgruntled fan that's kind of been left in the dark, so to speak. Well, we can still reach them. We can still explain to them that there's some common denominators between old and new school. And that's what we try to do right here, is try to show you know what, that thing you thought about all those years ago, 30 years ago, we can measure that now and actually confirm what your eye test told you back 30 years ago when you saw it, whether it was who had the best curveball or who was the best center fielder. How about Willie, Mickey, and the Duke, the golden era of New York? Who was the best center fielder? You know, we can peel back the layers and actually tell you now even more information about, you know, who was the best center fielder, who got the best jump. You know, Yogi Berra used to say about Joe DiMaggio, he never had to dive because he was always there. He was positioned right. He ran so well. He was so graceful that he would just run down fly balls. He never had to really dive. Well, nowadays we can measure that through Doppler radar, through tracking systems, through the Hawkeye systems. See, we can measure those sorts of things and confirm what you thought your eye test was. And we can tell you who the best center fielder was now. Now we can go back and say it was probably Willie Mays. You know, just for argument's sake, it was probably Willie Mays. But, you know, hey, Mickey Mantle was great. You know, it's hard to go against him offensively. He was unbelievable. Switch hitter. Duke Snider was great. Fantastic player. Didn't get enough credit. But, you know, nowadays we can back you up and show you exactly, you know, some metrics that can answer those questions. Who's the best at what? And that goes right back to, James, what you and I talk about, giving credit where credit is due. That's the most important thing I'm interested in, you know, is telling you who deserves what, who helped you win that ball game more, what plays were the most important to help you win a game, or who helped you win a championship, who contributed the most, who deserves credit. That's what I'm interested in. That's why we're doing this podcast.
Yeah. If you want that in audio form, we're your guys, right? so keep it right here with Toe on the Slab, but I think it's a good reading material. Check it out over at The Athletic. It's some free pub there for Lindsay and yes. Eno. Great job by them. And we definitely do enjoy their work on a routine basis, not just on subject matters like this. All right, guys, that's going to wrap it up this week. Big thanks to Josh Hader, closer of the Milwaukee Brewers, for coming on the show, joining us here. Big thanks, as always, to our great producer, Dan Rourke. And please, for all you listeners, be sure to rate, review, subscribe. It is the best way that you can support the show here. New episodes drop each and every Tuesday, so we'll talk to you next week. Toe on the Slab, Pitching with David Cohn, is a production of John Boy Media. We'll talk to you next week, everybody. Enjoy the Super Bowl. Take care.